When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, enough is enough. Rishi Sunak mounts an all-out bid to force the Rwanda plan through Parliament. Oh, God, with flights set to take off in 10 to 12 weeks, apparently. Rishi Sunak has said the Metropolitan Police needs to rebuild the trust of the Jewish community after an anti-Semitism campaign that was threatened with arrest at a pro-Palestine protest. Plus, people will now be able to sign themselves off sick for minor illnesses under new plans to free up GPs' time, despite the numbers issued doubling since 2015. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, only on Talk TV. It's the first show of the week, and it's a busy one. Of course, pressure mounts on Scotland Yard Chief Mark Rowley as angry Jewish leaders say they've lost faith in the police and are calling for him to quit. We'll speak to both sides coming up later on in the show. Plus, Vladimir Putin is believed to be behind a series of extremely dangerous attacks against thousands of British holiday flights. I'll bring you all the facts. And the Italians are waging war on ice cream. Milan plans to ban selling the gelato after midnight in a bid to stop antisocial behaviour. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Let's start the engines. The safety of Rwanda bill has been in parliamentary deadlock for the past 4 months. It seems like 4 years, doesn't it? And it's returned to both the Commons and the Lords today in what looks set to be a very long night. Yet despite being stuck in ping-pong purgatory, Rishi Sunak declared this morning that the first flights would take off, he says, in July.
For almost 2 years, our opponents have used every trick in the book to block flights and keep the boats coming. But enough is enough. No more prevarication, no more delay. Parliament would sit there tonight and vote no matter how late it goes. No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda. The first flight will leave in 10 to 12 weeks. Now, of course, that is later than we wanted, but we have always been clear that processing will take time, and if Labour peers had not spent weeks holding up the bill in the House of Lords to try to block these flights altogether, we would have begun this process weeks ago.
I thought they did start the process weeks ago, but I've sort of lost track, to be honest. My panel are here with me in the studio, Telegraph columnist Madeline Grant, conversation comedian Steve N. Allen, and broadcaster and author Laura Dodsworth. Very good evening to all of you. I'm terribly sorry that Rwanda seems to be back on the agenda. I was hoping for something a bit more interesting. But anyway, it's a long night, they say. They're going to be sitting there making all sorts of little amendments and convincing themselves that people care out in the rest of the country. I don't really want to talk about it at all. That's all I can say. But we kind of have to. No ifs or buts, apparently, is the new I'll stop the boats, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the statement that the PM gave this morning was kind of extraordinary because he was trying to almost spin it as, like, a good thing that it's been delayed a little bit because yes, it gives them time to get it absolutely watertight and robust. But obviously the whole affair just kind of screams weakness and the sense of impotence, not being able to get things done. And whether or not that's because of Labour peers and crossbench peers or anything else, it still exudes that sense of weakness, which is not exactly inspiring to the electorate.
Because it seems as though Rishi Sunak's got the idea that this will be his kind of, you know, his legacy. You know, see, I did finally get some flights to Rwanda, but in fact, it could end up being the death knell of the Conservative government because it will be proof positive that they couldn't actually get it done.
Yeah. Well, I think sense of impotence was a really good way of putting it because the sense of impotence runs a lot deeper than getting these flights off the ground. The fact is that we've had, what is it, coming up for 5,000 illegal immigrants come over in small boats this year.
Yeah.
And that is nearly 25% more than this time last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the Rwanda scheme isn't some ends in itself. It's a means to deter illegal immigration and to control the boats and illegal immigration. So we're not talking about the bigger picture. Which is the fact that the boats are still coming.
Yeah.
The Rwanda scheme is just one deterrent to stop the boats coming. The boats are still coming.
But it'll never end up being a deterrent. Like, best case scenario, this won't deter.
It will.
If you can try and focus on it just as one issue, you can pretend it's a bit of a win.
Right.
But the bigger picture, as you say, it isn't just about whether flights take off. I'm sure they will, but they'll be empty. I mean, we've spent such a huge amount of money on this for effectively nothing.
Right.
There was, a few weeks ago, there was a plan to roll out this scheme to other countries. What? To just give £200 million to other countries and achieve nothing? Is that replacing
comic relief? There was a whole host of people, apparently worse than that, and I said this, and I think you told me that I should have expected this to happen, that the coronation, all these countries are being sort of tapped up by various members of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to say, by the way, would you mind taking a few migrants while you're here at the tea and cake reception?
Here's 200 million.
Yeah.
You've got to look at the odds. Like, if you're thinking, will it deter someone from getting on a small boat? Well, not if the odds of you being sent there are so small. Like, just as a context, the pill is only 99% effective, but we still plow on with that, don't we?
Apparently so. It's an interesting dichotomy, that one. But, I mean, if you want a real deterrent, when you land on the shores of Britain illegally, you get put in prison and we don't let you out. That's a deterrent.
Mike,
then they'll stop coming.
Mike, but just not that long ago, think about the high-profile case of Abdul Azedi.
Yes.
So he was here illegally, and then he sexually assaulted and indecently exposed himself and wasn't put in prison or deported.
Right.
Then he supposedly converted to Christianity and went on to douse a woman in alkaline and pick up her toddler and smash this little girl repeatedly on the pavement in an effort to kill the child. Still not deported. So there's stopping boats and illegal immigrants, and then it's what happens when they're here. The whole system is rotten.
Yeah.
You know, the average British voter is appalled with the lack of controls on illegal immigration, the poor performance of the economy and the NHS. You know, the whole situation.
They don't look very busy in the House
really
of Commons. Look
at
the benches, are all empty. Even they've lost interest in it. Sorry to interrupt you there for a second, but there's hardly anybody there.
That's okay, rant over.
I mean, there was another couple of cases this week, last week, was there not, of people convicted of serious sexual offences, rape in particular, who can't be deported because they might be punished in their home country. It's bonkers.
We don't care about that. Truth is, do we care? I'm sorry, I don't. If someone has sexually assaulted a woman, the safety of women in this country, our own population, should matter more than their mental health or the prison they go to.
Course.
They're deported back to their home country
because
they should have abided by the law and not endangered the lives of people here.
Yeah, or in Azedi's case, he was attacking his own family. So it's people who have come here presumably with him that he's attacked.
But what I find... I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say just quickly on that one, that was because there was some religious expert vouching for it. We need to get the religion out of court. Of course, Christianity should be forgiving. That's what it does. You want your legal system to not pay attention to that.
Right.
Someone will vouch for you from the church. That's
exactly
what they do.
It's a nonsensical legal position to say you can't deport somebody back to the country they came from because they might be punished.
But at the same time, the Rwanda bill lets Rwanda send back anyone who's a criminal. So this is not just a bad system. It filters criminal asylum seekers to keep them here and send the rest elsewhere. Best case scenario.
Yeah. Bonkers. Just bonkers. The vote continues. I mean, we'll keep an eye on it, of course. But, I mean, as we've said, it won't really make that much difference, will it? I mean, has the House of Lords also been shown up to be a bit spiteful in this particular instance? Because we've now had probably too long... And it's gone backwards and forwards. And we know about the ping pong thing. But, I mean, it was meant to be finished and done by, I think, about over a week ago, wasn't it?
Well, actually, that was partly... The government could have pushed it through faster if they had insisted on late sitting times, really making people sit through until the early hours of the morning.
So they say they're doing that
and
now.
And doing it over Easter, but they didn't do that for whatever reason. So I think they do partly bear the responsibility for this.
Yeah. But, I mean, the House of Lords has twice inserted exactly the same... amendments after they were taken out. It just seems like I don't mind having a system that slows down legislation and has it properly, you know, debated and considered. But this just seems to be the House of Lords being bloody awkward.
It's disrespectful to the will of the British people.
Yeah.
This isn't some fringe issue. This is a big concern to the majority of British voters. It's coming up time and time again in polls.
Yeah.
And it just looks disrespectful to the process of democracy. It does look... morally virtue signalling and petty and spiteful.
Yeah.
And it's just disrespectful to the process.
Although the issue of asylum and migration is important to voters, but the issue of Rwanda, less so, with some surveys saying even Conservative voters think it won't work. So, so much effort is being spent to try and achieve something that even the people who should back it don't actually have any hope of it working.
Right.
Well, I don't think they object to the scheme on its own merits. They object to it because they don't think it's gonna work. If it could be made to work, then people would be supportive, I think.
Yeah.
But I think that many on the left almost argue as if it's sort of an unethical policy that people despise for those reasons.
Yes.
Actually, people would just be very happy, I think.
The problem for people on the left is that the asylum system is way different to what it was originally sort of thought to be when the whole asylum laws were drawn up. You know, and the left make no distinction between one asylum seeker and another. Whereas I think people who are sensible, and I'm not saying that all people on the left are not sensible, although most of them aren't, they can't tell the difference, you know. Like, anyone who arrives, oh, bring them in, just ship them all in, it's fine. They're obviously fleeing a desperate situation. Oh, look, there's one of them dealing drugs in a car. What are you going to do about that? Oh, they're fine, they should be able to stay here. Oh, look, there's a rapist over there. No, he can stay. You know, they don't have any kind of ability to differentiate between good and bad, it seems to me.
It just makes me really angry, because I think this is actually a very generous country. There are so many different bits of data that would suggest that we're a tolerant country in which, you know, multiple ethnicities can flourish in a way that they often don't in many other parts of Europe, for example.
No.
But this is just trampling on people's goodwill.
Yes.
You know, you want to help the genuinely in need.
Of course.
But then you have absolute chancers who are clearly abusing the system. And the fact that we seem to be now in a situation where there is absolutely nothing that we can do about this.
Right.
It's not even our politicians are not in control, because it goes off to, you know, the judicial system, which is incredibly complex and has become ever more complex ever since Tony Blair was in charge. You know, judges, lawyers, the ECHR, and none of it is accountable to the public at all. And they seem to have...
It is a government sort of in sort of limbo, really, because if you can't do anything, you're not really a government, are you?
Yeah. They're creating that limbo themselves a bit, though. So much effort on this totem of Rwanda instead of fixing the wider problem, which I totally agree with you. The wider problem is the bigger issue.
Yeah, but they can't fix anything, though. That's my point.
The wider problem is all of it. The things I'd like to see this succeed. Not necessarily because it is going to work as a deterrent unless they manage to, you know, get rid of lots of people to Rwanda, but because it's a symbol of success.
It is, yeah.
As Madeleine was saying, you know, there's the whole judicial system, there's the civil service, there's the ECHR. Basically, the government, which is trying to enact the will of the people, is floundering against people who are unelected and aren't accountable to us. And so that's the wider problem, and that's why you have situations where people like Abdul Azedi aren't deported when they should be. It's why the boats aren't stopped in the first place. There's this insurmountable wall of resistance to dealing with the problem. So I would like to see planes take off to Rwanda, because if nothing else, it would be symbolic that at least one plan is happening, even if it's not a great one.
And if you rewind to, I think it was, God, how long has this been going on for? Three years ago now, there was a flight that was due to take off, and then at the very final hour, there was some kind of phone call from a judge, and they weren't even sure who was responsible for this decision, but at the final hour, the flights had to be called off. And I remember Priti Patel...
There was, like, one person left on the plane, wasn't there? And they disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. But then Priti Patel came to the Commons, was absolutely furious about it. But it's precisely that kind of level of unaccountability that is... You know, has meant that the Rwanda scheme hasn't worked out. I'm not saying it was a brilliant idea to begin with, but it's a symptom of the wider problem.
It's true. Anyway, you've proved me wrong, because you managed to speak for a lot longer about it than I thought you would. But let's talk about Hugh Edwards, the other big story of the day. Well, we'll be talking about it later on in the show as well. But yeah, I mean, Hugh Edwards finally decides to resign from the BBC approximately 9 months after he was taken off air for all sorts of shenanigans. And he's now said to have taken medical advice, and he's now leaving. Various reactions have been seen on social media, most of them going, well, it's about bloody time, and why did it take the BBC this long to come to this conclusion, which they probably wouldn't have even come to if he hadn't resigned?
I don't think they could. From my limited time working for the BBC, it's amazing how much people are unsackable. If you do something incredibly bad, they just move you to another department. Or, as we see, just let you keep getting paid for a while. Their system, I'm sure it was in some way originally invented to be good, you know, but basically you get a staff job there.
Yeah.
You're there for life
exactly.
if you want to.
Yeah.
You'd have to really break some laws.
You really have to do something terrible to have to actually be abandoned by the BBC. But I was going to say, they still haven't abandoned him. You know, he was still the highest paid newsreader until today.
Yeah, the amount of money he probably got on sick pay could have paid for a show. This is what's wrong with the BBC.
Right.
In the fact, I don't like the idea of the big earners making that much money, not because I don't think they're worth it or anything. That's not even the argument. That money can make about 17 different episodes of something and they're not making enough shows. Right. So stop paying these people way too much.
Well, exactly right. But surely if something like that happens, and we know that it took a long time for it to come to fruition anyway, after the original complaint was made by the family, that he was paying somebody for, you know, some rather obscure pictures that were going back and forth between them, the BBC sort of froze. They didn't know what to do because he was a big name, and because when they have these people who are all powerful, they're frightened of even asking them a question. Like, what the hell do you think you're doing? And he said the wrong word there for a minute. Sorry. But I find it astonishing because there's no other organisation where that would happen.
Yeah. I think there are many organisations in which that happens. Where
really?
People who are important and influential get away with all sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know, I think we saw that with Channel 4 and Russell Brand as well.
Yeah, but nobody complained about that until years later. I mean, they actually okayed it when it was all going on.
I think there was a lot of very brazen behaviour going on at the time that they turned to ignore.
Well, they chose to... No, they didn't ignore it. They actually endorsed it. They went, you can carry on and put these shows out, like the BBC did when Russell Brand was doing that.
And Philip Schofield, I think, is another good example. It's kind of understandable why a big company doesn't want to kill the cash cow, that you want problems to go away, but that eventually ends up causing more problems, isn't it?
But the thing for the BBC is there's no such thing as a cash cow because it's all our money and they're paying it to all these characters. And now they're all talking about, well, who are we going to get to do the election?
Well, this is a big problem for the BBC because I think...
What, for the BBC, Mike?
No, they can't afford me.
Oh, my God, I think some heads would explode if that...
That would be funny, though.
But, I was just thinking, like, who is the new... Because for me, I remember growing up, Hugh Edwards on every single day.
Well, his voice is on all the Queen
voice
stuff,
and so many of those moments of, like, in the national consciousness. Like, who is the next Hugh Edwards at the BBC? Because they don't seem to have that same level of, like, household names, reassuring voices, etc. Maybe you have to kind of cultivate people and really...
Yes.
And
having that star system doesn't encourage other people to come through, does it?
Yeah, the BBC's also got rid of a lot of its old-timer presenters, newsreaders who were good, to replace them by some people who aren't. I mean, there's a few court cases at the moment about ageism.
Yeah.
So that's not developing people who will be the trusted voice and hands to do those
occasions. They're a bit like the government, the BBC, aren't they? Can't seem to get anything right. I mean, for years now, that's where we are. Anyway, we'll be back with this panel and with much, much more on Hugh Edwards as well. You're watching The Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, public trust in the police is hanging by a thread after successive failures. Now, of course, they're fighting off allegations of anti-Semitism. More on this coming up after the break. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republican, Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Now, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, says he's appalled by the way police treated a Jewish man during a pro-Palestinian demonstration in London. Gideon Falter, who was told by an officer that his presence risked breaching the peace as he appeared to be openly Jewish. The force have said that they're going to invite Gideon Falter to meet with him and apologise to him personally. I'm now joined by the founder of the Israel Solidarity Movement, Keith Fraser. Thanks for joining us, Keith. This is a very, very weird story. Just before we start, I've got a new statement from the police who have said this. We remain focused on doing everything possible to ensure Jewish Londoners feel safe in this city. Today, Assistant Commissioner Matt Twist has written to Gideon Falter to offer a private meeting to both apologise to him personally and discuss what more the Met can do to ensure Jewish Londoners feel safe. Together, we will work through a range of protest scenarios and invite direct community feedback to inform and challenge not just our operational plans, but our communications during and post-event as well. It seems to me, to be honest, Keith, that we've had this problem really since October. You know, I've been saying since October that they've got to do something about these marches. They've got to do something about the fact that they seem to be free to take over parts of London as and when they choose, that people who wish to demonstrate against them, like the Iranian guy who was pulled off the two different situations because he was saying that Hamas were terrorists, to now have Gideon told that he's openly Jewish, he needs to get out of the way. It's an extraordinary state of affairs. And also, I want to put to you, and I'm sorry to make this such a long question, you know, I'm amazed at how many people have said, oh, well, the thing is, he's obviously an agent provocateur and he obviously went there to cause a problem.
Well, first of all, Gideon, even if he was a journalist, you'd probably say that's very interesting investigative journalism, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And you would have to say, well, what he uncovered was extremely alarming. By the way, I've just, for those people out there. This is the first night of Passover, and I've just interrupted my family Passover feast to join you, Mike. And
well,
no, we're not
kind.
Eating bread containing the blood of Palestinians, contrary to the Arab school book or the people on the hate marches. But coming back to your question, Mike, in all seriousness, look, for whatever reason he was there, whether you believe him or not, what was exposed is very obvious. And I actually don't agree with you, Mike. It's happened long before October the 7th. Jewish people in this country have felt this for years and years. Let me tell you, for years and years, there have been umpteen marches from Stop the War. You go back, for example, to just before the American and British invasion of Iraq the second time, there was a march in London. Why? They had to put it on there. But if you look at the placards, which are all socialist worker placards, by the way, they've got all the socialist worker emblems on there. It said on it, do not attack Iraq, freedom for Palestine. Typical left-wing sort of label they all want to jump on top of. The truth is, no, Jews do not feel safe going into central London with these marches. And the fact that policemen stopped a Jewish person walking across the road, in fact, threatened to arrest him for doing so, basically is saying, you know, let's persecute the innocent here. And also admitting to the fact that the crowd who were there in the hate march is effectively admitting they could be violent, aggressive, hostile. Well, says it all, doesn't it, Mike?
Well, it does, and that is the problem. And let me bring in Leroy Logan, his former police superintendent. Leroy, thanks for joining us. It seems to me the problem here is that the police who are on the street are sort of caught in the middle because they've obviously been told by their superiors and possibly by Mark Rowley himself, you know, you've got to be so careful here. We don't want to upset the people marching for free Palestine. And so we want to try and keep the Jews away. I mean, clearly that's been the message, hasn't it?
Well, I'll be surprised if that's the message to keep Jewish people away. I think it's, as you say, police are in a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
They have no powers to stop these marches. And it begs the question, why hasn't Parliament put in legislation to say, listen, there is a set number of marches you can have. It can't go on for
months.
But
I thought when because we've had these conversations for a long time, haven't we, you and I? I thought there was a situation where the Chief of Metropolitan Police could ask the Home Secretary to cancel the march.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have the power to do that, but they don't.
Well, there is that. Or Parliament can put in legislation so the Commissioner doesn't have to. The legislation would dictate that. So that's the first thing. And then you've got to recognise that officers have discretion how they're going to deal with things. Sometimes they're not totally au fait with the legislation and don't know how to put it across in a way that it's actually for that person's well-being and safety. Because if you look at it another way, if he had said, oh, yeah, go right ahead and walk through that crowd, police would have been lambasted for allowing a Jewish person getting hiding for nothing.
Well, surely that's his choice, though. Well, I mean, if that was the police's job, surely they'd be stopping people from getting assaulted in every situation. But they're creating a situation suggesting that he might be assaulted, which is not the same thing.
Well,
it's really not
theoretical. No, I understand, but the thing...
I'm not putting a police officer down on sort of Old Compton Street at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I wouldn't walk down there if I were you, or stopping them from doing it because it might not be safe. Well, you might want to walk down there. You might want to take the risk.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're trying to facilitate a protest with the minimum of disruption to the public and bystanders. So it's just a question of if he's allowed to cross the road and it's against their instructions because they're saying, well, that march has to go through with a minimum of disruption and any risks to anyone, then the officers have to hold that line.
Well, let me go back to Keith on that. Keith, you were listening to what Leroy had to say there. We also know that less than half of the public now trust the police. I mean, I don't think it's the police's job to stop people from walking across the road in any situation, do you?
Do you know what, Mike? I don't even know what the police's job is these days. Over 80% of burglaries go unsolved in London. You know, like I said earlier today, the same mob who go on the Just Stop Oil whatever they do in disrupting people wanting to get to work or to hospital. They've obviously gone silent because they've got something else to sort of jump on the bandwagon on. But what do the police do? Those people are disturbing the peace. If you've got people who can't get to work, people who cannot get to hospital, and people take their own take the law into their own hands to try and get them out of the way, and the police arrest them, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
We have to go after the protagonists. We have to go after the people who deserve to be gone after, the people who are truly disturbing the peace. And the police are just not doing their job. Crimes. Look at knife crime. Look at the situation with the fact last week we read that in Tesco's they're going to stop people coming in a certain town because they're worried about all the shoplifters. Hello, are we not a country of law and order here?
Well, that's a good question, one from Leroy. Are we not a country of law and order anymore? So few people trust the police. What's gone wrong, do you think?
Well, it's not an overnight. This has been developing for 10, 15 years where the grip on policing has slipped. I mean, I'm not making excuses for senior leaders and the wider organisation for not getting a grip of, you know, basic policing. Mm. But when you lose such a large number, 20,000 cops nationally...
Yeah, but that's not the issue, though, is
it? No. But in all honesty, you've got to bring it into context around officers are leaving in their droves, right? So as they bring them in, they're leaving. And as a result of that, you are not getting experienced cops anymore. Right. I mean, even when you're talking about your burglaries, I was burgled in 2016 and I had my car broken into early this year. And the caliber of officers, it's not there. They are young officers with 6 months in investigating quite complex issues and crimes. So in all honesty, there is a real skills gap, an experience gap in the Met, and it's not just in policing on a day-to-day basis, but it's also around how they're dealing right. with these large operations.
Yeah, OK. Well, let me go back to Keith. But, Keith, I mean, can you imagine, for example, it may well be that there are fewer police than there were, maybe all the good ones have left, but I can't imagine, personally, a police officer going up to a Muslim and saying, well, you're obviously openly Muslim. If I were you, I wouldn't walk over there because something bad might happen to you.
I think it's very unlikely. And what we saw a few weeks ago was the whole subject about the Islamists dictating the narrative in this country. And we know that to be true. And the police and the government have been walking and, you know, sort of sleepwalking. This is a massive, massive problem. You know, we only had a poll, what was it, last week before, where you've got the 32% of Muslims in this country want Sharia law. I mean, if we don't wake up and smell the coffee, it's not going to be unpleasant for Jewish people to live here. It's going to be unpleasant for people like you and everyone else to live here, Mike. The police need to get a grip. And if Mark Rowley is worth his salt, he will be able to delegate effectively and be a leader, educate his force about how to communicate, how to keep people safe, and how to go after the protagonist rather than the person who's defenceless and innocent.
Yes, and I think that's right. Keith, thanks very much indeed. Keith Fisher there. I think, Keith Fraser, rather, sorry. Let me end with you, Leroy. I think he's right. I mean, surely what's gone wrong here is that the police have kind of lost the ability to see not necessarily who the bad guys are, but to see where the trouble is coming from. And they're allowing those who are causing the trouble to continue, and they're stopping other people who might want to go about their business from doing so. Isn't that what's going on?
Well, that could be a good reason, but I really think there is a lack of, I think, skills in how you're policing. I mean, I used to be based in Westminster,
right.
So we used to have a very good brief from Central Ops. Ops would give us a clear steer on how they've dealt with the stakeholders who, you know, are asking for the march or whatever, and as a result of that, we were very clear. It seems like all the legislative changes as well.
Right.
I think officers are confused. And that's why they're blundering into situations. And if you've got someone who's, you know, got his camera crew and his security and they're willing to try one or
but
two...
But everything's on camera now, isn't it? I mean, there's people, they're filming
absolutely.
Stuff.
But
the body cams
times,
being worn...
And it's not just in these situations, but how many times you see officers being shown to be heavy-handed or very flippant or very rude and you know, they disregard that.
Yeah.
And they've got body cams as well.
Exactly. To, I mean, isn't them. Somebody, so, I mean, you know, just knowing from what I know.
It's a lack of supervision as well.
Yeah.
The lack of supervision. Listen, I used to be out and about with my officers, even when I was a superintendent. Yeah. I'd be riding around the streets of Hackney to ensure that what my strategy is being rolled out by the troops. And as a result of that, if it wasn't, I'll develop them.
Right.
And if they
but also, but surely you would also, as a leader, you would say to them, look, this is how you this is how you act. You don't speak in that way to people, members of the public, who have not done anything wrong. You don't call people openly Jewish. You don't. You wouldn't call somebody, well, you're obviously a black man, so you shouldn't go down there, or you're obviously a white man, so you shouldn't go down there. You wouldn't talk like that.
Of course not.
Well, why is anyone telling them that?
Yeah, it's what they have said, this officer said, is totally inappropriate. It because remember, that same person went to various officers, and they dealt with it in a way that he didn't see the need to put it on social media. So, you know, again, and that officer's a sergeant. So something in, you know, I think it's around this toxic culture that's developed in the police, that anything goes, certain things will be said in private, and they're now spilling out to public. And it beggars belief that a supervisor could speak like that to a member of the public in full gaze of cameras and...
Don't think
it's just a one-off.
No, beggars belief, I'm sure it's not. And, I mean, the fact that it's on camera, you would think they would have some kind of recognition of that. Leroy, thank you very much indeed. Leroy Logan, former Metropolitan Police Superintendent. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, Mad Vlad suspected of thousands of extremely dangerous aviation attacks on British holiday flights. I'll bring you all the details coming up after this. Welcome back to The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Russia is believed to be behind what aviation experts are calling extremely dangerous electronic attacks against thousands of British holiday flights. The tactic renders sat-navs useless, so aircraft are unsure of routes and struggle to tell others where they are. More than 350 attacks per week were suspected last month. And joining me now to discuss this is Jerome Starkey, Defence Editor at The Sun. Jerome, welcome to The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Nice to see you again. I must admit, the first thought I had when I read this story was I'm rather disturbed to know that that our flights are actually using sat-navs while they're up there in the skies, 30,000 feet above the Earth. I thought they might have something slightly more sophisticated, to be honest.
Well, flights have, like, a number of mechanisms so that should one fail, they can fall back on another, the most simple of which is known as dead reckoning. You know, if a plane travels in a certain direction for a certain amount of time at a certain speed, the pilots can calculate where they are. But sat-nav is an incredibly sophisticated and normally incredibly reliable means of knowing where you are, just as useful for aircraft as it is for you and me in our day-to-day lives as we're, you know, walking around or driving around trying to find our way through areas we don't know. If anything, it's more useful in the sky because, of course, they're not necessarily travelling along roads or past landmarks that they can see if they're in clouds or whatever, and in crowded airspace as well. And it's not just how they know where they are. Crucially, it's also how they tell other aircraft and air traffic controllers where they are as well. And that's why this is so important, because if a plane doesn't know where it is, if it can't tell the air traffic controllers exactly where it is, if it can't transmit to other aircraft in the sky exactly where it is, and if all of those aircraft are in the same position, then there is potentially a really serious threat to air safety.
Right. And is this similar to something that happened to Grant Shapps some weeks ago when he was over in Poland? I remember when he was flying back to the UK after having said a few what might have been seen as inflammatory things about Vladimir Putin, that the Russians were believed to have somehow jammed, you know, the satellite navigation or the radar even on his plane.
Mike, that's absolutely right. So I was on that Royal Air Force jet with Grant Shapps last month as we flew back from Poland. He'd been visiting British troops who were taking part in Steadfast Defender, the largest NATO drills since the end of the Cold War. And, you know, Grant Shapps had been in the cockpit of the aircraft. He came back into the plane and revealed that the pilots believed they were being jammed. The GPS, the Global Satellite Navigation System, was not working, and nor, coincidentally, was the aircraft's satellite connection to the internet. Now, at the time, one of the Defence Secretary's aides called that wildly irresponsible, Russian behaviour, wildly irresponsible. Plane was about 60 kilometres from Kaliningrad, the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad, and it's thought that's where the jamming emanated from. Now, it was because of that that I was sort of tempted to look into this in more detail and see whether or not civilian flights were being targeted. And we've discovered that, you know, yes, they are. And thousands, tens of thousands of flights in Europe are facing jamming, have faced jamming, certainly just in one small area that we looked at. 40,000 flights jammed since August.
Yes. And what I understand from your dispatch was that most of those flights would have appeared to have gone sort of further east, I suppose, if you like, in Europe, so that they were geographically closer to where Russia could perhaps interfere with them. Is that, does that mean that there is a geographical limit to how far they can jam them, as it were?
It's a really good question. There are three jamming hotspots, if you like, across Europe, and they all run roughly in a line north to south. So you've got the Baltic area, which is where we looked at, and we focused on that partly because it's a hotspot and partly because that's where Grant Shapps' RAF jet was when we were jammed last month. The second area is the Black Sea, particularly the Dardanelles and the sort of, so the entrance to the Black Sea, parts of Turkey and Bulgaria and Romania. And then the third area is the eastern Mediterranean, particularly Cyprus and the coast of Israel. Now, I happen to know in 2021, a few years ago, I spoke to very senior UK defence officials who were at that time accusing Russia of deliberately interfering with GPS signals over RAF Akrotiri. That's the Royal Air Force base on the southern tip of Cyprus. This was described obviously before the war in Ukraine, the full-blown invasion, as sub-threshold activity. I don't know if it seems a long way back, but if you cast your mind back before that invasion, everyone was talking about grey zone conflict and how Russia was meddling in this threshold below war. And that sort of GPS interference was grouped in with that kind of grey zone activity. So we know Russia's been doing it over Cyprus. We know anecdotally that Russia's been doing it in the in and around the Baltic from its Kaliningrad exclave. I have no reason to think that they may not also be doing it in the Black Sea. But of course, you know, there are sometimes legitimate reasons for interfering with GPS. Both sides of the conflict in Ukraine use this as a mechanism to try and defend their military assets, because if you can confuse an aircraft, you can also confuse a drone. You might be able to confuse a missile and therefore make something that's trying to attack you less accurate.
Yes. And is there anything that the commercial aircraft companies, airline companies can do if they know that this is a likelihood that it might happen? Is there something that they can protect themselves with that they can buy, if you like?
That's a really good question. And the European Aviation Safety Authority held a sort of emergency safety meeting, if you like, earlier this year with IATA, which is the body that represents airlines, to discuss exactly this, jamming and spoofing, two types of interference with GPS, which they interestingly described as attacks. And they said there'd been a sharp rise in these attacks. They were sort of calling for more to be done, but weren't saying what concrete steps could be taken. And I think that's where the concern understandably lies. This has been called out as a serious concern. They described it, the EASA described it as a significant challenge to aviation safety. We've heard UK defence officials suggesting this could potentially put lives at risk. Now, aircraft do have, as I mentioned at the very start, a number of systems for navigating. They do have fallback mechanisms. But nonetheless, given the reliance, the sort of the standard reliance that most aircraft put on their global satellite navigation systems, it is a concern. It's a serious concern. And that's why aviation sources telling us, as we research this article in today's Sun, this is potentially extremely dangerous.
Indeed. Jerome, good to talk to you. Great story. Thank you very much indeed. Jerome Starkey, their defence editor of The Sun. Given what's going on in the summer of Just Stop Oil, it's going to be a pretty difficult scenario just going on holiday by the sounds of it. We'll bring you more on that, of course, as it happens. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, British households face a £400 hit from the switch to net zero. And Rishi Sunak is spending your money on yet another online scheme to tackle sick note culture. Sounds promising, doesn't it? Nah. See you in three. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for Taking the Mic. It's been an instructive few days if you were in any doubt about the political bias at the BBC. First up, it was question time at the end of last week, where Reform leader Richard Tice was brave enough to offer himself up as the target of ridicule from the oh-so-Labour-supporting audience. Green Party leader Carla Denyer was also on the panel, and so when the subject of net zero came up, naturally, she was revealed to be a fully paid-up member of the cultist club. But when Tice started to question the cost to taxpayers and the efficacy of the policy, he was immediately attacked, not just by Denyer in the audience, but also by the host of the show, Fiona Bruce. There was simply no room for any kind of dissent from the agreed science, according to the apparatchiks and believers in climate change. Anyone who thinks differently must be an idiot. At one point, Denyer asked Tice what his background in science was. Cue much laughter from the audience. Her background is as a councillor in Bristol, where she managed to get a climate emergency declared. Fast forward to Sunday and Laura Kunzberg with her usually oddly selected panel. This week we had the pleasure of seeing the eccentric Chris Packham, who's on record as saying he would support breaking the law to save the planet and now regularly speaks up on behalf of Just Stop Oil criminals. This week, though, even she excelled herself with a hagiography of Chris Stark, the chief executive of the government's climate change committee. Her interview with him was full of giggles, nodding at his answers and friendly exchanges. At no time did she wonder why most people in the country are now seeing through the climate nonsense and are fed up paying through the nose for policies that are clearly not making any difference to the state of the world anyway. They even managed a snide reference to Liz Truss into the bargain. So much for the BBC and its attention to detail. It looks like the state broadcaster is now officially a lost cause. Today we learn that despite Rishi Sunak rowing back on his net zero pledges and the SNP cancelling their net zero targets altogether, the crazy environmentalists will still cost us dear in the future. According to the leading think tank, the Resolution Foundation, the switch to net zero will cost families as much as £400 extra per year because of the jump in interest rates. We will all be spending an extra £29 billion on energy by 2050 if interest rates don't return to 2019 rates. And no one sensible believes we'll see them at less than 1% anytime soon. The blind faith in renewables and clean energy needs to be properly questioned and investigated. The green billionaires don't want that. They prefer the BBC approach. Interrogate nothing. Agree with everything. Act as if anyone who disagrees is a climate denier. Our future deserves a lot better. Now, Rishi Sunak is overhauling Britain's sick note system to try and increase the workforce. Brits may be able now to sign themselves off work using an app under plans to free up doctors' time. Ministers want to test an online system that will mean people with minor infections and injuries can get a few days off without seeing a GP. Let's talk to Senior Principal GP Dr. Dean Eggett and find out what he makes of it. Dr. Dean, welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Seems to me you won't fix sick note Britain by giving people permission to give themselves time off sick without actually seeing a doctor, will you?
Well, I'm not completely convinced by Sick Note Britain. There are lots of people taking time off sick at the moment, but I don't think that's changed a huge amount over the years. At the moment, we're up to about 10 or 11 million people per year taking sick leave. And actually, you can already sign yourself off sick. So for the first 7 days of illness, if you feel poorly and you need to take some time off, please do so. It's called self-certification. It's only when you need longer than 7 days do you need permission or to seek advice from a healthcare professional for sick notes?
I thought it was only 3 days you could sign yourself off for. I thought more than 3 days you needed a doctor's note. But I'll take your word for it since you're a doctor. I wouldn't know, you see, because I don't sign myself off sick unless I actually genuinely am sick. But I think there's a large problem which has been identified not just by the government but by various people since COVID in particular, since the work from home brigade started working from home, that, you know, it's a lot easier to write yourself off sick because nobody sees you anymore. So, I mean, if you haven't seen your employee for a month and suddenly you get a note from them on email saying, I'm not feeling too well, I'm not going to be able to come in today, it's pretty difficult to prove otherwise, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to hold my hand up here and say, as a GP, actually, there's not a huge barrier to getting a sick note from me. I know my patients reasonably well. And when they come to me and say, look, Dean, Dr. Eggett, I'm sick and I need some time out, often I take their word for it. I don't necessarily need them to prove X, Y, and Z for me to write a sick note. Actually, I don't even need them sometimes to come in to see me face to face to get a sick note. So it's already the case that you can send me an email, you can log on via my website, or you can log in via the NHS app and request the sick note and get one. And that practice is common now over England. So first of all, you can self-cert for 7 days, and if you need a sick note thereafter, it's already pretty easy to contact your GP. So
right.
The question...
And you've just told me, right, you've just told me that you don't believe the Sick Note Britain, but you basically just told me that anybody can write you an email, you'll give them another 7 days off, maybe more, so they can have 2 weeks off without even having to tell anybody what's wrong with them.
Yeah, well, that's probably the case. Actually,
well,
when I give a sick note, they don't have to say that there's nothing wrong with them. They have to prove to their employer that they're unwell, because when I give a sick note, it doesn't necessarily mean that the employer has to believe that. They can invite the employee and discuss it with them. But I still don't believe there's a Sick Note Britain, because the concept of the Sick Note Britain is that people are feigning illness, and that's not reality. The reality is that Britain is sick. We're overworked. We have long-standing aches and pains and worsening mental health. This isn't people faking illness. This is people being sick.
Well, hang on. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that anybody can be sick for 7 days without having to have anybody check them, and then they can get a further 7 days or more from you without you having to check them. I mean, if I said to you, I'm not feeling very well, you wouldn't give me 2 weeks off if you were an employer. Why would you? You know, the reason that we've no productivity in this country is because there are so few people producing anything. And so until such time as it's made more difficult for people, they're going to take time off because they don't fancy working. We know that because there's an awful lot of people who are on benefits who don't wish to take a job because it's more convenient for them not to bother. So, you know, you may be half right, but you can't be 100% right, because there are an awful lot of people taking time off sick. I accept that the NHS failure to look after people is part of that problem, and the fact that the NHS didn't see anybody during COVID unless they had COVID has also created a problem. But at the end of the day, it's very much easier now to be off sick than it used to be, and that's not a good thing.
My heart breaks, Mike. I mean, you're being provocative there, suggesting that we're working during COVID. So we worked astonishingly hard.
I'm not saying you weren't working. I'm saying you didn't see anybody who didn't have COVID.
Ah, that's not true either. So we were asked to work remotely. We worked remotely. And you know what? That's worked. Loads of patients don't want to come in anymore. They don't want to get stuck in traffic.
Don't need to.
They don't want to have to go into a car. So what's wrong with using telephones? What's wrong with using the internet? You don't necessarily have to come in to see me face to face.
Well, call me old-fashioned, doctor. If I want to tell how sick you are, I want to look at you.
Yeah, you're old-fashioned. You know what? You are old-fashioned. And because talking of old-fashioned, I'm quite an old-fashioned GP too. I live in the community in which I work. And actually, you don't need to come and book an appointment to see me to tell me you're sick, because I know my community. You know, I have 5,500 patients, and I know them quite well because I live and work around them. I see them in the shops. I know them. That's good old-fashioned general practice. And for those who aren't practicing good old-fashioned general practice, it may have to work slightly differently. You can use the telephone and you can assess people over the telephone. You can use the internet and you can assess people over the internet. People don't necessarily like having to make journeys, coming in cars and take time off from other daily activities to come and see the GP anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the right thing to do.
Well, it may well be. It seems to me it's gone too far in the wrong direction. We'll have to have a longer debate about this because we're out of time, unfortunately. But good to see you, as ever. Don't take any time off, for heaven's sake, no matter what's wrong with you. You're watching The Independent Republican, Mike Graham. Unbelievable. Coming up, Sir Keir Starmer's got a patriotism problem, as 1 in 8 of his voters think the St George's flag is racist and shouldn't be flown. More on this Keir Laverty coming up after the break.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at Burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker. Coming up in this hour, Donald Trump is in court to hear the full prosecution against him in the first ever criminal trial of a US president. The Welsh newsreader Hugh Edwards has resigned from the BBC on medical grounds, the corporation announced in a statement. And shockingly, 1 in 8 Labour voters think the English flag is racist and divisive and should not be displayed. Now, I've seen some political vault face in my time. I've seen Sir Keir Starmer declare Jeremy Corbyn to be his friend, only to dump him out of the Westminster Labour Party when he was done with him. I've seen Nicola Sturgeon tell a journalist there was plenty left in the tank, only to watch as she resigned her job as First Minister of Scotland only days later. And who can forget Boris Johnson insisting that he had full confidence in Matt Hancock just days before he resigned from the government? Politicians aren't often the most reliable source of consistent behaviour after all, and perhaps we shouldn't expect them to be. But this latest about-turn by the Labour Party is particularly hard to stomach. I'm talking, of course, about Sir Keir Starmer's new love-in with the flag of St George, coming as it does on the eve of St George's Day tomorrow. Yes, indeed, the party that has consistently made people feel ashamed to fly the flag of England is now touting itself as the party of patriotism, the place to go if you feel proud to be English, or even British. That's the same party that Emily Thornberry represents, and that's the same Emily Thornberry that sneered at White Van Man a few years ago when she saw a house in Rochester, Kent, draped with the same England flag. She was sacked from the shadow cabinet for that, and now she's back because she's the shadow attorney general. And it's the same party that even today has 13% of its members that think the flag is racist and divisive. And those figures get worse in the devolved nations, another great idea from the Labour Party under Tony Blair. In a poll conducted over the weekend, it seems clear how much damage has been done to Great Britain overall, thanks to giving parliaments to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. In England, 44% of respondents said they were best represented by the Union flag. In Wales, it's only 24%. And in Scotland, it's even fewer. Just 17% think the Union flag represents them. But Captain Flip-Flop isn't concerned. Writing the Telegraph, the Labour leader said his is now the true party of patriotism. Starmer says he has no time for those who flinch at displaying our flag because the Cross of St George belongs to every person who loves this country and seeks to make it better, a symbol of pride, belonging and inclusion. Well, perhaps he should tell that to the people who burned it in the past or those who prefer to brandish a Palestinian flag every weekend. Only last month, several Labour MPs were refusing to hand out leaflets with a Union flag on them, warning that its extensive use was detrimental in areas with large ethnic minority populations. And let's not forget the Ramonas, who were still whining on about the loss of their star on the EU flag, which, of course, isn't even a country. Marvellous, isn't it? Only parts of Britain are patriotic. Some of it isn't. Have a very happy St George's Day, because I know I will. It's tomorrow, don't you know? I'm going to keep this just to remind me of my pride in the country in which we live. Happy St George's Day to all of you. Now, later on in the show, we'll bring you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Sun newspaper, an extraordinary story, which you may have already heard about, but it's about Gogglebox star George Gilby, who died from traumatic injuries to the head and torso after plunging through a warehouse skylight. This is an inquest that was opened and suspended as police and the health and safety executive are probing what actually happened to him. The hearing was in Chelmsford in Essex. Senior coroner Lincoln Brooks said, "I formally opened the inquest into the death of George Gilby. I would normally open it and adjourn it, but I have received a request to suspend it from Essex Police." It's not very clear exactly what's happening, but George from Clacton in Essex died on March the 27th after a fall at the EGL home care warehouse in Shoebury near Southend. A man in his 40s has been arrested on suspicion of gross negligence, and that is under investigation. So obviously that story is going to be running for quite some time. We'll have a look at some other front pages of the newspapers and other stories as well a little bit later on in the show. But let's move on, because Donald Trump has been on the receiving end of a grilling in court as the opening arguments were made in the first ever criminal trial against a former president. A rather punchy encounter took place this afternoon. Manhattan prosecutors accused Donald Trump of lying over and over again to cover up payments made to porn star Stormy Daniels in the days leading up to the 2016 election. Trump railed against the court and prosecutors on social media and once again denounced the case as a witch hunt and election interference. And to discuss this a little bit more, I'd like to welcome Greg Swenson here from Republicans Overseas UK. Greg, very warm welcome to you. Thank you for coming back in again. We spoke about this last week. Yeah. We saw the Donald Trump new campaign advert, which is based on this case, based on how they're trying to shut me up because, you know, they want to shut you up. I'm not going to be shut up. I'm going to keep going to court every day. An incredible piece of advertising, really. Yet the case goes on. He continues to slag off the court and the judge and the prosecutor. It's quite a bizarre situation, really.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, obviously, it's unprecedented. But I think you have two things going on here. One is, you know, this is an outrageous case of election interference, right, or the weaponization of the justice system, like I've said many times. You don't have to like President Trump to see what's going on, right, here. And you see a lot of prominent Democrats like Alan Dershowitz that have come out against this. But the second thing is, you know, they waited for, in this case, 7 years, and in the other cases, they waited 4 years, right, to actually file these indictments. They only did that after he announced he was running, yes, for president. So it just shows you how blatant of this is and how blatant the election interference is. But he's converting it into a campaign.
Right.
You know, and as
and
much
probably
as,
quite successfully.
Absolutely.
I mean, I see that in the last, I think, the last three or four polls I saw over the weekend, he's stretching his lead ahead of Biden.
Yeah, it depends on the polls. It's a little bit challenging this early. And, you know, the Biden's come back a little bit in some polls. One of the big concerns that we have in the party is that there's polling on registered voters, but it doesn't really reflect the voters who plan on voting or, right, will vote on election day. And Biden and the progressive left are now the party of the college educated,
right,
voter.
Yeah.
And those voters always vote.
Yeah.
Whereas the blue collar, the working class voters that have become a really important part of the Republican coalition, they're not as reliable. And so, you know, voter registration and voter outreach, as well as get out the vote, is, right, going to be really important.
Interesting. Now, going back to the case, they're basically accusing Donald Trump of committing election fraud. The prosecution have said that it's election fraud, pure and simple. The defense says Trump had no personal involvement in the payments.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the crux of the case. But interesting,
right,
the first witness is going to be David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, who is accused of buying up negative stories about Donald Trump and basically not running them.
Yeah, burying them. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that should be interesting because, you know, how they turn this from a misdemeanor, which, you know, falsified business records,
right,
is a misdemeanor in the state of New York. Alvin Bragg is a New York prosecutor that's prosecuting a federal law.
Right.
And so there's so many holes in this thing.
Well, they're saying it's not simply an accounting issue, aren't they? They're trying to make out
they're gonna
that,
tie
it's, that it's
to the campaign.
An illegal, you know, it's illegal under electoral law.
That's right, because they're going to try to connect it to a felony,
yeah,
which they have to do to make this misdemeanor a felony. However, they tried this, you know, the Republicans tried this with John Edwards,
right,
who was a candidate in 2008.
I remember him, yeah.
And, and used, you know, campaign funds to pay off his mistress.
Right.
And they actually voted against it.
Right.
The court said, no, this is not a campaign expense. He didn't want his wife to find
out. Right.
You know, it's quite obvious.
And,
so,
I mean, despite whether you may like Donald Trump for doing it, you know, having paid money to Stormy Daniels in order to keep her quiet, that's also not particularly a serious offense anyway.
No, unseemly, of course,
yeah.
but it's not illegal. And
right.
it's not even a misdemeanor. The
right.
falsifying the business expense, that's a misdemeanor, but it's one of those who cares,
yeah.
it's a speeding ticket.
Right.
You know, pay the $100 fine. So what, you know, Alvin Bragg, who ran on his campaign slogan of I'm going to get Trump,
right.
is trying to stretch this from misdemeanor by connecting it to this campaign thing. The prosecutors in the past looked at this case and chose not to run it
right.
because it was so obscene.
Right. And one of the things that was interesting last week, I thought, after his earlier appearance in court, was Donald Trump went up to Harlem, which you wouldn't necessarily expect to be a sort of a bedrock of Republican support, you know, relatively working class area, very ethnically mixed.
Yeah.
And they loved him.
Absolutely.
And he was, like, getting cheered to the rafters. He went to a bodega, bought some stuff. He went over and talked to the cops, who all love him.
Absolutely.
They were chanting his name.
I mean, this minority or identity group coalition that not only have the Democrats had for generations, but they depend on it.
Right.
They cannot live without it. They cannot win that without it. No Democrat has won the white majority since LBJ in 1964.
Right.
They're completely dependent on the black and Hispanic vote. That is frazzling. That is not holding in. So if Trump, all he has to do is get 20% of the African-American vote,
yeah.
and he wins.
Right. And as you've said before, there are seven sort of swing states, as it were, aren't there? Or six.
That's right.
Which, if he can win the majority of those,
that's right.
he's in anyway.
He's up four in the swing states. In those same states, he was down five
right.
this time in 2020.
Okay.
And then if you look at the issues, he's polling up 10 to up 25 on all the different major issues, you know, the border, inflation, who's capable of handling it, who's physically and mentally aware
right.
enough. All of those metrics favored Biden
right.
by 10 points or more in 2020. Now they're favoring President Trump by 10 to 25.
Right.
It's phenomenal.
And, I mean, the other, I suppose, interesting aspects of what was going on over in the States over the weekend was the voting through of the monies to Ukraine. A lot of Republicans not happy about that.
That's right.
A lot of right-wing Republicans particularly unhappy about Ukrainian flags being waved in the House of Representatives.
I thought that was obnoxious. And I think Mike Johnson did the right thing and said that's, you know, a violation of our decorum.
Right.
So, you know, I thought that was a little much. I thought, you know, I was glad that the legislation passed on all four of the bills.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed, of course, that the border security bill did not pass. You need a two-thirds majority for that. So they did get the majority, but not two-thirds. But look, I totally understand some of the Republican pushback. 101 Republican House members voted for it, 112 against. Look, that's messy democracy.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be messy.
Right.
And it was bipartisan. Half the Republicans roughly voted for it. So, you know, this isn't some outrageous, you know, this is not some outrageous moment like you're hearing from MTG and others like her.
Yeah.
But, you know, they put it up to the vote and it passed. So
right.
Good for Mike Johnson.
But the flag thing's interesting because I'm looking at my St. George's flag here. It's St. George's Day tomorrow.
Yeah.
Ridiculous in America that you would even have this conversation about the national flag because, you know, every house in the States has an American Stars and Stripes flag.
Not every house, but not as much in New York and Washington and San Francisco. But, yes, the people that live in the country, throughout the country in flyover land, they fly the flags. They're very proud of it. Then it's only at Columbia and Yale do you see
But that's a relatively recent thing, isn't it? Where they'd rather wave the Palestinian flag than wave the U.S. flag. But, I mean, generally speaking, you would not be having conversations in America,
certainly
20 years ago,
totally
about the flag being racist and divisive.
It's much more patriotic there. It still is, in spite of some of the hiccups that we're experiencing in the last year.
I mean, you had it with the Confederate flag, haven't you? I mean, that sort of became something that was untenable, and people that used to fly it in the South now don't.
And you really can't. And I think that ship has sailed, and I think it's probably for the greater good. You know, look,
I was disappointed with the Dixie Chicks, though. I quite like that name. They changed it to the Chicks, and I was like, how does that work?
Their political correctness started and, you know, in America and was exported here, I regret to tell you. But I think it's the pushback has started against wokeness.
Yeah.
And, you know, so far, so good.
Right. So There are 34 counts, just going back to the trial briefly, of falsifying business records. I mean, do they have to prove all of those in order to get a conviction?
That's another part of the scam. It's one violation of this New York statute that's, again, a misdemeanor. Yeah. What he did is he carved them up into 34 different counts by saying every time a payment was made, because he carved out the payments into, you know, $10,000, for example, payments. So he segregated each payment and each recording of the payment in the books just to get 34 indictments, thinking that it makes it look bad. It makes it look worse for Trump. This guy was, even if he doesn't get a conviction, but if he gets one conviction, he should get all
the convictions. This reminds me of the Georgia case, right, where there's something like 96
Same deal. I think it's 91 total.
Sorry, 91 total. Four. Some of which involve things like an email being sent, which is one count.
Yeah.
Right?
And look, that's prosecutors and the district attorneys frown on this. They always advise against their lawyers not to do that. It's very sleazy to do. Alvin Bragg did it anyway. But everything he's doing is sleazy at this point.
Well, so, it would seem
no surprise.
So. And what about the jury? Because we were told it might take 2 weeks to get a jury together of people who didn't have an opinion on Donald Trump. They managed to do it in 2 days.
Yeah, the first day was rough. Right. You know, last week we were here and I think they didn't have any on the first day.
Yeah,
but yeah, they managed to get it through. It probably took a few days longer than anticipated. But look, I think I'm still worried about that. It's New York City. It's Manhattan. If you look at you know, they had some information about each juror, where they get their news sources. I mean, it's a lot of New York Times, a lot of TikTok. This, I think it's going to be difficult for him to get a fair trial. And you know, Alvin Bragg and the judge are doing their best to prevent Trump from getting his right to due process and his right to a fair trial. Now, having four indictments at the same time, two of which are active, also is really frowned upon by attorneys and district attorneys in America.
One of my favorite questions to the jury is, do you listen to talk radio? Which, of course, doesn't require them to listen to our version of talk radio. But, I mean, it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
They're sort of saying if you listen to talk radio, therefore
you're a conservative.
You're like a right-wing nutcase.
Yeah, and there is that sort of stereotype.
Yeah.
And you know, look, I mean, I probably say the same thing about New York Times readers or Washington Post readers. And so is it fair? No, but it's probably pretty close.
It's pretty accurate. So, I mean, will it continue like this, do you think? I mean, will there be this ridiculous standoff between Donald Trump, former president, who comes out every day and says something that he's not supposed to say, but then nothing really happens to him?
Yeah, I mean, they've tried little versions of gag orders. Right. They've had some restrictions on them. I don't know that it will work. I think, again, I can't call whether there's going to be conviction here because of the hostile jury pool.
Right.
But I think this is going to help President Trump. 6 months ago, I was saying it's helping him in the nomination, but it will hurt him in the general. I'm not so sure about that anymore, Mike.
Because I think once it happens, you know, the shock perhaps, I mean, we even, when we think about it as the first time a president has ever been prosecuted in a criminal case, once you get past saying those words, you realise that it may not be quite as damaging as it would first appear.
Yes, because if it was a legitimate, you know, an actual crime, then you could say, wow, this, you know, you might have said that about Nixon if he had gone, you know, if they had gone through with the impeachment before he resigned. But, you know, look, this is so obviously a witch hunt weaponization. And it's quite clear to me, but I think it's quite clear to Americans. And none of these cases, this is another way to look at it, none of these cases, especially the Alvin Bragg case, would have been prosecuted against anyone except Donald Trump.
Right, exactly. And so they've kind of drawn the facts gently towards what they hope will be a conclusion, in other words, right?
No, absolutely. And coming from Alvin Bragg, who's deliberately reducing felony crimes, violent felony crimes in New York to misdemeanors so he can let violent criminals out on the street. It just makes it's when you look at it in the context of that, and as well as, again, if you would file this indictment against anyone but a political opponent, which makes it all the more wrong to do it.
Incredible. It's very
really
good
amazing.
To see you. As
Thanks,
Mike. Greg Swenson from
good
Republicans
to be here.
Overseas. Now, Britain's largest water company, Thames Water, has put in a bid to hike water bills for up to 16 million customers by as much as 44% over the next 5 years. They aim to spend at least £1.1 billion more, they say, on environmental measures, but currently have debts of almost £15 billion to contend with. To discuss this is consumer expert Adrian Mills. But Adrian, before we come on to that, welcome, by the way. You've worked at the BBC.
You.
You've been one of the stalwarts of that organisation when it used to be good. What do you make of the news about Hugh Edwards resigning, finally, having taken some medical advice?
Yes, I think it was to be expected. I think the big hoo-ha a few weeks ago was when people discovered that he was still being paid his full BBC salary, licensed payers' money. And I think that's what was the shocker to most people, because I don't know about you, but I was aware that if you were sort of taken ill, that you got your salary for a certain period of time and then you were put onto sick pay.
Right.
It works for the BBC. It probably works for you, Edwards. Interestingly enough, this very day, some friends said they'd seen him recently, and they said he was like a zombie walking, that he was just devoid, and his eyes were sort of, you know, gone, and they felt sorry for him.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for him because he is down and registered as being very depressive, manic depressive. He's talked about it in the past. However, and I've said this time and time again, it is quite extraordinary how many people always show regret and contrition and sadness once they've been caught out. Probably enough said on that one, I think.
Well, possibly. But, I mean, a lot of people also critical of the BBC for not really doing much about it. I mean, the fact that he's gone is entirely on his own decision as opposed to on their decision. There's no evidence, it seems to me, that they've sort of suggested that he might want to think about leaving. And the other problem he's left behind is the legacy of Hugh Edwards and all the things that he used to do. For example, you know, the Queen's funeral has got Hugh Edwards all over it. So what are the BBC going to do when they have to, say, replay some of that sometime?
Well, if you look at the history of the BBC with various presenters that they've had that have now wiped from history because of their misdemeanours, then I think they have got a bit of a problem. I don't think... I mean, they will use the excuse of, you know, there's mental health issue here. None of us know, and this is important, none of us know how badly... you know, affected Hugh Edwards is. So I suspect the BBC will still show clips. However, I find it astounding that it's taken this long, whether they were waiting for him to sort of say enough and walk away, or whether they were terrified that if they fired him, there'd be some huge lawsuit, you know, it remains to be seen.
But that's the thing, and I mean, it's quite interesting that he hasn't said that he's suffering from poor mental health. He's saying he's quitting on medical advice, which is not the same thing at all, is it?
Well, if you remember, when his wife spoke out, she said, you know, it was enough to stop the press chasing him. And she said, Hugh Edwards will make a statement about what has happened in the near future or in as soon as he feels better. But when will that be? I doubt that statement will ever come. And to be honest, if you think about it, you know, and I'm sort of saying, you know, once people get caught out, they're all full of regret. There's a long history, isn't there, with presenters on huge salaries. I think the regret comes knowing that you're going to lose your £500,000 a year salary and all the kickbacks that you get for doing corporate speeches and videos.
Yeah.
And it goes right through, doesn't it? Philip Schofield is an example. John Leslie before Philip Schofield. Yeah. Frank Boff at the BBC all those years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's nearly a football team of them, as somebody pointed out to me today, but that's another matter. Let's move on to your other sort of hat, which is the consumerist hat, because I, for a long time, have worried about the water companies in this country. They don't seem to know what to do when it rains too much. They don't seem to know what to do when it doesn't rain. They don't seem to know how to control the water coming into the land. They don't seem to be able to control the water going out of the land. So, basically, what are they good for?
Well, as the old expression goes, you know, water, water everywhere and not a drop to spare. I mean, it's quite extraordinary after all these years that we haven't got provisions for, you know, larger reservoirs. It's going to take 5 years before three reservoirs even come online, apparently. So, you know, we are wasting water. You see pipes burst on roads. You see the sort of the sewage, as we've talked about in the past, being pumped into rivers at such an alarming rate. And a decision on that 44% increase will be made by Ofwat, who are the regulators, on the 23rd of May. We won't know about it until the 23rd or the 12th of June, rather. And that's when we can start to see larger bills. Southern Water, incidentally, are looking for a 66% increase. But what sticks in the throat for me is their new director. He's only been there a short while, but his salary, it's people's salaries in these companies. It's always the companies that are failing that where they get paid a vast fortune. He gets paid £850,000 a year. He gets £102,000 in shares, and he gets a 15 grand a year car allowance, plus a bonus of 156% of his salary. That's £2.3 million a year. And to put it into perspective, because I can't think what 2.3 million looks like, that's £44,000 a week.
That's ridiculous.
For failure.
That is unbelievable. And, of course, they keep telling us that, you know, they need to invest more in the infrastructure. Well, for as long as I've been alive, I think, they've been talking about trying to fix the leaks. There's billions and billions of litres of water leaking into the ground every single day, right? I remember back in 2011, they were digging up all the streets in London, Thames Water, telling us that they were fixing all the Victorian drains and the systems and the pipes because the Olympics was coming to London and they didn't want that to be any problem. You know, it's now 12 years later and they've still got the same problem.
Well, what they will say is, oh, but don't forget, we've got the huge super sewer, which is going to be running across London soon. That's cost a small fortune.
Yeah.
They have actually said that they're going to invest £1.1 billion in environmental improvements, but they haven't quite said what those environmental improvements will be.
No.
And yet again, it's another case of large, large conglomerates with overpaid salaried personnel just being unaccountable and being fairly useless at what they do.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for any of us? Because, you know, it does seem to be ludicrous that this continues to go on. The regulator seems to me to have nothing but, you know, soft talk for the regulate for the criminals here, who are the people providing us with the water. They don't seem to stick up for the consumers at all.
No, I don't think there is any light at the end of the tunnel. You know, Ofwat, I think, will be fairly toothless and will allow them to increase bills quite considerably. You know, light at the end of the sewage tunnel, that's, you know, a story in itself, isn't it? It just beggars belief that this country, which we call Great Britain, is more like Little Britain every single week.
It really does. I mean, it's more and more ridiculous. I mean, we were talking about the Rwanda situation earlier on, which I'm so bored with, I can't even begin to tell you. You know, but there's nothing seemingly that the government can do to make anything better. You know, we're being told that, you know, we could be spending 400 quid extra a month, a year in the next few years because of net zero commitments on our energy. The water companies want to put our prices up by 66%. Some of the councils are putting up their council tax by 20% because they're all going bankrupt. I mean, it's unbelievable. Can you tell me anything that works properly in this country?
Well, no. I mean, you know, my 93-year-old mother constantly says, you know, we're all going to hell in a handcart. Well, I think we're almost there, to be perfectly honest. You know, the truth of the matter is...
The wheels have fallen off the handcart, I think.
Every single thing in life... is either more expensive, more of a rip-off. We're being conned left, right and centre. I always think that if we were the French, we'd be out in the streets sort of going berserk, but we sort of take it on the chin and go, well, we're Britain, you know, that's the way it is. And it shouldn't be like this.
No, it really shouldn't. I mean, do you expect Labour? I mean, they've talked about trying to sort of nationalise certain things and then they've gone the other way and said, no, we don't want to do that. That was last week's idea. This week's idea is not to nationalise it. I mean, I never thought I'd say this, but I wonder if they should nationalise some of the big utility companies and, you know, the energy companies and the power companies as well, because they're just taking the mickey now, aren't they?
Well, I think you're right there, Mike, and I would completely agree with you that I never, ever thought that we'd be in a situation where that you would talk about renationalising some of these industries. But the sheer cost of doing it, who will pay for it? Yeah. I suspect it will revert back to you and I, Joe Public, and higher taxes. I think Labour have got a poison chalice, to be perfectly honest, and I think Conservatives are almost to the point where they just can't wait to get out of office because it's all gone so pear-shaped, and they'll be working on the assumption that it may just go just as badly for Labour over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I think you may well be right. Adrian, good to see you. Good to talk to you. Thank you, as ever.
And
Adrian Mills, a consumer expert, former BBC presenter, of course, as well, with an interesting view of Hugh Edwards. We'll talk some more about Hugh Edwards coming up. But you're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Next, a leading school teacher is calling for 12-hour school days. Elsewhere, a city is banning ice cream and pizza after midnight. Could it happen in your city? Find out after the break. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. The UN's Palestinian Refugee Committee must improve its screening of staff for pro-Hamas sentiments, according to an independent review into the agency. The review was commissioned after Israel's allegations that 12 United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees employees are members of Hamas and other terrorist organisations and were actually involved in the October the 7th attacks. My panel are back with me, and let's start with that Middle Eastern conflict story, because it seems incredible, doesn't it, that when we discovered that not only were some of the sort of aid agencies inside of Gaza quite pro-Palestine, some of them are actually more pro-Hamas. And the fact that some of them members of UNRWA were actually fighting on October the 7th in Israel as Hamas operatives.
Yes, two died.
Yeah.
10 were sacked.
Yeah.
And then at the time, Israel made the allegation that maybe 12% of UNRWA were either Hamas or other terrorist organisation affiliated. Yeah. Now, this report, this independent report commissioned by the UN, has been investigating the neutrality of UNRWA staff more generally.
Yeah.
We'll remember there's going to be a separate UN report on the 7th of October, which might go more deeply into those UNRWA members who were involved.
Right.
But this report says that Israel has not yet provided evidence of 12% of the staff working for Hamas. But the report does contain some really worrying findings, actually. So, although it downplays them a little bit, I haven't read the report itself. I'm just going by the reports of the report that I've read in the media today. It says that nearly 4% of UNRWA school textbooks are problematic. And you'd think, oh, nearly 4%, is it that bad? But the problems that it reveals are really quite serious. So one being, for instance, that textbooks were describing Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, or an Islamist textbook glorifying jihad and saying that, you know, glorifying martyrdom as well. So that's effectively propagandising the next generation. Also, it has found that staff are not sufficiently neutral, as demonstrated by social media activity. I mean, at the moment, I think that we probably need to wait for this other report into the 7th of October to come out, because there is a risk, I think, that there's a little bit of whitewashing going on. Even if Israel hasn't provided evidence to back up its earlier allegations, 10 staff were sacked immediately for being involved in the 7th of October, which is completely unacceptable, an attack that killed 1,200 people. And as of today, 133 hostages are still held in Gaza.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a thing that very rarely gets mentioned, isn't it? And I mean, for the UN to do a report into a UN sort of affiliate organisation and to conclude that there are problems with Hamas sympathisers, that tells you a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's big, but I do think that the some of the people appointed to look into these allegations are people that I would say, if this were kind of, I don't know, a sort of some kind of statutory report, they would have to be excused for reasons of conflict of interest. So Catherine Colonna, who's a, I believe, a retired French politician who was tasked with leading this review, she had been very active on social media talking in the months that before she undertook this review, talking about the essential nature of UNRWA as an institution. You know, she'd been saying, you know, talking about the vital work that it does. Mm. That would seem to me that, you know, this is somebody who, you know, already at least has a view about UNRWA and is invested perhaps in its continued success. So that's not exactly an impartial person that should be leading such an investigation.
Well, also UN Chief Antonio Guterres, right?
Yeah.
That's the top man, isn't it?
Yeah, and he said that the UN stands by UNRWA in the light of this report, which is why I'm saying, you know, there may be a little bit of whitewashing going on here.
Yeah, there might be. And also, it's still politically incorrect, isn't it, to be critical of anything that comes out of Palestine, really. And we get an awful lot of people saying nowadays, oh, you know, one of the reasons Israel must stop going into Gaza and going into Rafah and various other places is because they'll be creating the next generation of terrorists. Well, I think it's already a bit late for that. You know, I've always been dubious of those who say, actually, you know, most people in Palestine don't like Hamas, because I've not seen any evidence of that either.
I think you can criticise some of Israel's actions that and criticise them for not always taking as much care as they should to avoid civilian casualties, and still be, you know, I don't buy this line that no one's allowed to criticise anything Israel does. You know, you could be a critical friend of Israel and accept that Israel is a country that's surrounded by adversaries and that they may, you know, at times not be anywhere near careful enough. Yeah. And the level of civilian death in Gaza has been absolutely horrific.
Well, we don't know. Hang on.
Well, that depends on who you talk
to. We really don't know what the level of civilian death is. And one of UNRWA's problems, for instance, is it uncritically repeats Hamas's death figures, and Hamas is a terrorist organisation. And I mean, I wouldn't take at face value the words of people that invade a country and murder citizens, including women and children.
Well, perhaps not the precise statistics, but in such a heavily built-up area where there are going to be so many children, for instance, it's very hard to avoid catastrophic loss of civilian life. Yeah. This is what happens. Urban warfare is the most
But, for example, kind of warfare I heard a report. Yeah, I heard a report on the radio the other day of an attack on a building somewhere in Gaza, and the report said 18 people were killed, 14 of them were children.
Yeah.
And that was on the BBC, and you go, well, you don't really know that, and I'm not disputing that there weren't people dying.
No.
But there is a narrative that is put out by Hamas, which is that all the people that are killed are innocent, all of them are civilians, and most of them are children.
And it's
I just don't believe that.
It's true, and it's also quite fascinating that within moments after an attack, they're able to have such very detailed and accurate statistics about the numbers,
right.
Yet they can't say, for example, how many hostages are still alive, right. Where they're being kept.
And according to Hamas, none of the people who are killed in Gaza are members of Hamas. Not one of them, you know?
Yeah, it's all about controlling information.
Yeah,
but to your point that you don't see a lot of pushback, I do think it's worth bearing in mind that if you are just some Hamas-hating Palestinian and someone comes up wanting to do a survey about your opinion, you could probably keep it to yourself. So you probably might
that's
not.
That's the other problem.
Yeah, you might not hear a lot of pushback.
Yeah, no, that's true. Let's talk about the London connection to it all, because we were speaking earlier to a police officer, a former police officer, and a Jewish organisation leader as well, talking about this business of what happened at the weekend and whether or not we're going to see some kind of change in actions from the police in this country and in this city in particular. It seems extraordinary that this happened at all to me, but talking to Jewish friends of mine and talking to Jewish advocates and sort of leaders of the community, they're not surprised at all.
No.
It's shocking.
It was a really, really shocking exchange and really quite shameful to witness in our own capital city, in this country, which has been a safe place for Jews to live for many decades. And what's been, I think, really disappointing about the exchange we saw between Gideon Falter, who heads up Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, and that Met police officer, is subsequently people have said, well, he was provocative.
Yeah. Ugh.
As though that excuses the clear danger that he was in from protesters, the verbal abuse he got, and being threatened with arrest, and being told that being openly Jewish was enough to prevent him being there.
Yes.
So he's organising a walk for people to show that, you know, the streets of London should be safe on Saturday. I'll be joining it. Other members of the British Friends of Israel will be going. And what I find really sad is that I know Jewish people who've said thank you to me because I said I'll go on the walk, but they don't feel able to.
Right.
And that's a really shameful situation.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting was, I think, was it last weekend or the one before, where there were more people actually on a support for Israel march than there were for the Palestinian march, because it has dwindled over time. I mean, I can't believe they've been doing it for as many weeks as they have since October 7th, but for the first time, apparently, there was more people who turned out for a sort of Israeli peace march, if you like, than there was for a from the river to the sea scenario, you know? But the police have obviously got a real problem here because, you know, they've now realised, I mean, they've put out now three different statements since the incident. You know, the first apology was not an apology at all, so they had to recant that, put out another apology, and then agree to meet with people, and they're now saying they might be meeting with them even as we speak tonight. But, you know, for them to say those words, there has to be a culture within the police.
It's a very bad look. And frankly, everyone who's defended it is showing their anti-Semitic colours.
Yes.
Do you remember the, was it in the 80s? Not the 9 o'clock news. There was that sketch where Rowan Atkinson's playing a police officer saying they arrested someone for being visibly black.
Yes.
And that was a joke back then.
Yeah.
And now someone is threatened with arrest for being openly Jewish. Yeah. Now, there are, obviously, I think there are two elements here. There's the police officer picking the wrong words.
Yes.
And there's the policy from up high, which is the bigger problem.
Right.
Because the way that they're policing these marches is fearing one side.
Well, exactly. The principle is, well, we better not mess with them because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Which is not really called policing, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They should be policing without fear or favour.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened all the way along. I think the real problem is that they set the wrong tone at the first march.
Yeah.
If you remember, Suella Braverman called it a hate march.
Yes.
And I have to say, I think she was right. Well, I said so at the time.
Yeah.
They were hateful. That first march was shocking. People weren't just marching for out of sympathy for Palestine. You know, they were calling on Israel not to return a shot before it had. They weren't calling for the return of the hostages or for the surrender of the terrorists. And I think people got away with those sort of genocidal chants, right. You know, global intifada and from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. It wasn't policed effectively from the outset.
And we've been saying this for months, haven't we?
People have become emboldened. They think they can just do what they want. I mean, I found it very shocking to see that that chap saying to Gideon Falter, I'm watching you, I'm going to watch your movements, right. I'm going to follow you around, in front of the police.
Yeah.
And he wasn't reprimanded.
No.
He wasn't arrested. That's so intimidating for somebody
to say
they're going to follow you around.
And we've had a couple of instances, have we not, of some demonstrators doing sort of cutting their throat sign to groups of Jews who are watching. I mean, it's just incredible. But, you know, I suspect nothing will change for a while, but maybe it's beginning to change and maybe it's beginning to calm down. Let's look at the front page of The Sun. They've got Hugh Edwards. After a 40-year career, BBC cuts shamed Hugh Edwards adrift with no thanks and no payoff. Yet the mum who complains still gets no answers. And then inside they've got, we're still suffering. And these are the people who kind of caused this all in the first place, the parents of the teenager who was receiving the money and the various images from Hugh Edwards and sending him images. It's all very tawdry, isn't it?
I don't get this front page at all, though. No thanks, no payoff. Well, he quit. So it's not really cutting someone adrift. And do you expect a thanks after a scandal like this?
Yeah.
But if the details of the scandal, there's a question over what was... There was nothing criminally wrong due to the age of people concerned, but there's morally wrong.
Yes.
And if someone's done something that's morally wrong, you don't get a big fanfare kind of, let's do the half-hour show of goodbye to Hugh Edwards.
No.
His greatest bit. It's not like he's left Big Brother.
No.
So I'm not quite sure why they're so surprised by this, but, yeah, it's...
Well, I suppose it's indicative of how badly the BBC took care of everything and didn't take care of it. He didn't do anything for ages.
Yeah.
And then when they were suddenly shocked into it by the Sun newspaper, they suddenly had to start doing something and they still even then didn't do anything, really.
Yeah.
That's the problem. After 40 years of service, Hugh has explained that his decision was made on the basis of medical advice from his doctors. I mean, it's a pretty short statement from the BBC, isn't it?
It's interesting, all the push news alerts today with him with the words breaking news next to him, which is obviously not the first time, is it?
No.
Normally, it's not about him, it's about someone else. It was
absolutely not. Now, let's talk about ice cream, because apparently it causes, in Italy anyway, certainly not anywhere else I've ever heard of, antisocial behaviour. They're closing ice cream shops in Milan, which is not my favourite Italian city, but, you know, I love Italy. Apparently, people go crazy for ice cream.
That's what you got to watch.
I know.
It's not about the boozers, necking the pints or doing the shots.
I mean, in this country, people have fights on the way to their holidays. That's what we see.
They should probably ban English people from entering Milan if they actually wanted to stop. What are they putting in the ice cream? Sounds good. Sounds interesting.
It does sound interesting.
I mean, it's not like the problem we have in lots of towns here with circuit bars and police vans outside waiting for everyone to spill out after late opening.
Well, the problem
we
now have in London, and nobody's out late enough to get into any trouble.
And I would
They're all home in bed by 10 o'clock.
I would say this is probably like, is this a sign that maybe Italy is heading in the direction of Soho now, which is a shadow of its former self. You can't get a... You can barely get a drink off.
See, I haven't been to Soho for ages. Is that bad?
Venues have closed rapidly there. And it often has not to do with... I mean, part of it's to do with, you know, the very high costs involved, the cost of rent, the cost of everything else. But it's often because of complaints by residents and overzealous local councils, which I just think is bonkers.
I'm sorry, if you live in Soho...
You're going to live in Soho.
Right.
But a surprising number of people choose to live in Soho rather than, you know, Wiltshire or somewhere and complain about, guess what, there are people drinking after hours. What they do next in Soho.
Because when I first moved back to London many years ago from having lived in Scotland for a while, I thought at one point of getting a flat in Soho, but I remembered from being there that, you know, the bin lorries are going around at 4 in the morning.
It's probably a bit
noisy, you know. Probably during the day quite noisy as well. So if you're looking for a quiet place to live in London, that's not it.
Could have moved to Shaftesbury Avenue, but I tell you, nearby, it's like Piccadilly Circus out there.
Very similar, not far away. Very good. A hop, skip and a jump, you might say. Right, we'll watch some of the other stories in the papers in a moment. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. After the break, we'll take a trip to the world of woke. And, of course, we'll have tomorrow's news tonight. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
Now, today, ladies and gentlemen, in case it has escaped your notice, it is Earth Day. And if you don't know what that's about, it's an unwavering commitment to end plastics for the sake of human and planetary health. So if you've used any plastic today, you're an absolute traitor to the cause and a heinous individual. I did a quick stock check to see whether I had, and I used milk from a plastic container in my tea this morning, shampoo from a plastic container in the shower, a cling film on the food I had in the fridge for lunch, and the credit card I used to buy petrol. Heaven's sake. Oh, dear, I'm not going to get any Earth credits today, am I? Unlike those big companies that are so virtuous when it comes to saving the planet and their hypocrisy. This morning, I got a reminder from Microsoft that they are committed to sustainability. They told me they want to give devices a second life, supporting a greener future without compromising on performance. Of course they do. They certainly didn't want me to buy a new laptop for my son, did they? Meanwhile, over at Apple, things aren't going quite so well. It looks like they've had to suspend production of their vegan iPhone cases after backlash from customers who said they were basically crap. Less than a year after the tech giant offered a vegan alternative to leather cases and watch straps, it's all got a bit wrong. Apple introduced Micro Twill, made up of recycled textiles and other fibres last September, after announcing it would no longer produce leather accessories as part of their environmental push. The trouble is, punters haven't taken to them. According to an avalanche of complaints, the vegan versions are easily scratched and they get worn out much quicker. The fine woven cases and watch bands cost between £99 and £149. Apple boasted that they had a sophisticated look and a significantly lower carbon footprint than leather. But in their new adverts promoting non-leather, there is no room for the fine woven range, only the cheaper silicone ones. Let's hope there isn't any plastic in them. Lately, Apple has cut the amount of packaging around their new iPhones and they no longer supply headphones or charging cables. Of course, that doesn't stop people using headphones and charging cables. It just means they have to spend more money buying them. And they also keep changing the charging connection so that older chargers don't work anymore. Cue more expense for their customers. I don't mind companies doing things to save the planet. I just don't like companies that pretend that's what they're doing, when actually all they're doing is making more money. Because that is the world of work.
The world of work.
So what have you lot done for Earth Day today?
I sent loads of cards, which I think is against what they wanted.
Yes.
I've done a few trees.
Well, as long as they're not plastic cards.
Yes, oh. were they made with twill from recycled...
Micro-twill.
Micro-twill.
That is the stupidest thing ever. So Apple, who mine the earth for rare earth metals, yeah, have small children in factories slapping this stuff together, but at least the case doesn't have any cow on it.
I know.
Does anyone fall for this hypocritical twaddle? I mean, no. It's just such nonsense.
Well, you know, they used to fall for it. I think I'm seeing a kind of a slight reduction in the amount of wokery going on. I wonder if it's starting to decrease and decline.
Maybe. And I really, truly think that the best way to be more environmentally friendly, call me a Luddite, is if you went back to the past where actually everything that's leather is made out of leather, not plastic,
right,
or twill, whatever. And, you know, I mean, imagine if all our clothes weren't made in, you know, sweatshops of polyester, whatever, but proper, you know, Harris tweed,
cotton,
and linen, and are made to last.
But so, you know what they say about cotton?
They say
that cotton uses...
And fur, let's not forget fur, naturally biodegradable.
Oh, we mustn't forget fur. Careful,
there
are going to be people standing outside with paint for us, Madeline. What do you think?
They'd rather have a plastic coat that takes 5,000 years to decompose than something that came from nature and is of nature. Mm,
I know, it is absolutely ridiculous. But that's the other thing. You know, people are out there now realising, actually, that there isn't any point to recreating something when it actually could be had naturally. It's like, why would you buy a ready-made meal in a supermarket? I was in a supermarket on the weekend, and I had no idea how hideous some of these ready-made meals are. They've now got... They were selling macaroni cheese pizza for, like, £5. Selling fish and chips, like, you know, ready-made, you know, just put it in the microwave, it's all cooked. It's like, why are people buying that?
I'd definitely buy both of those things.
Would you? Well, at least go to the fish and chip shop.
That's true.
Or the pizza place, you know.
That's true.
Don't buy it in Sainsbury's or any other...
I think, when you have, like, one of those ready meals, it's often... You're busy, but you're not enjoying life. You know, you've got to get a quick snack down.
But it takes no time to cook something and put it in the freezer and eat it later, does it?
That's true, that's true.
So the answer is, wear your mink coat to the local fish and chip shop and buy a proper...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about David Beckham, because there was a big story at the weekend of the big 50th birthday party for Posh Spice, where they all got together again and sang, and there was videos of it and everything else, and everybody looked very happy. David Beckham is suing Mark Wahlberg when it says the question here is this the end of their 15-year friendship? I think this is quite a big story.
I would say it is the end of their 15. I mean, have you ever...
when you get sued by your best friend, right?
For that amount of money as well. For that amount of money. Yeah. I don't know anything about this story, but I do use Instagram, and there's something about... I mean, for some reason, and I don't know why, because the algorithms are normally very smart and very aggressive on Instagram, but I keep getting little videos of David Beckham on Instagram, and I don't know why, because I'm not interested in him, but he's putting on makeup.
Right.
And I think he picks out his wife's brands.
Right.
And for some reason, and I think this is serious and it's
so
not a parody,
actually him
he's
putting,
putting
it on.
Little bits of bronzer on and... balming his lips or whatever.
He's always
don't be fair. There's nothing more unattractive than a man making Instagram videos and putting makeup on.
He's bankrolling businesses. He probably wants them to turn a bit of profit.
Also, Madeline's right. He's always, he was the first man in Britain, I think, to start using moisturiser when he was a young footballer.
It's the first man to use moisturiser.
And now everybody's using it.
Oh, what a pioneer.
He was a sarong pioneer.
He was.
And hairbands.
Hairbands, the whole thing.
I think this whole Beckham suing Wahlberg thing is actually kind of amazing because I feel like the noughties has just come alive. Marky Mark and Golden Brothers facing off against each other.
Exactly
except
right.
Men didn't wear makeup in the noughties, Madeline.
That's true.
Then this is about a fitness...
Well, except Beckham would have done, probably. I mean, this is all about some fitness company that they started. Wahlberg co-owns a thing called F45 Training. Beckham agreed to be the US firm's global ambassador when he moved to LA. But he now says he was misled. Well,
so I think what's happened here is that the share price had been a lot higher and it has now plummeted from, I think, like $12 to $3 per share or something like that. So he's basically said, I wish I could have divested myself of my shares when it was in the much more in the pink.
Never do deals that involve shares.
Yeah, but that's just the market, isn't it? I mean, you know, there's hindsight is always 20/20.
Right. And if somebody's giving you money, then you take the money. But if it says, we will give you... Because he says, he claims he lost more than £8.5 million in stock because the promised stock did never arrive and the share price plummeted.
Wow.
Well,
he should spend more time with his accountant.
You know, I finally got senior enough at the Daily Mirror to get stock options, right? And by the time they fired me, they were so worthless that I couldn't cash them in. And at one point, they'd been worth like 120 grand or something. And when I got fired, I went, how much are these worth? And they went, nothing. I went,
He needs more time with his accountant and less time with his wife's makeup bag.
If it's a fitness thing,
I love an old-fashioned woman.
Mark Wahlberg wouldn't have time to actually get around to doing this because I don't know if you remember when he posted his daily routine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like wake up at 3:30 to go to the gym.
Works out all the time, doesn't he?
And then on his way to the gym, he does some gym work. Right. And he sits in a room and thinks about how good he is and then does some more gym. Then he goes to bed
and
5 hours after he woke up.
Without makeup on. It's the most ridiculous rippling abdomen.
So no wonder he didn't have time to run a business and lost lots of money.
I don't believe that anyone's day is actually what they say it is. No one could live like that.
You shouldn't.
It'd be a good court case, though. We'll pay money for that one. You know, it'd be like O.J. Simpson, but not quite as dangerous, obviously. That's all from me tonight. You've been watching The Independent Republic and Mike Graham. Thank you to all of my beautiful guests. I'll see you tomorrow at 8 p.m, only on Talk TV. Good night.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.